Have you suddenly been overcome with an irresistible urge to wash your potato? Have you begun to open your eyes and are trying to make sense of the world you see around you? Well, you've come to the right place. You are at the 100th Monkey Radio. What's really going on? Prepare yourself for a journey with Tom and Ramon as we continue our search for the 100th Monkey on the 100th Monkey Radio. We've got a good show coming up tonight, don't we?
Very great show. You almost sound like a professional.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. I auditioned that in front of the mirror for about 5 hours today just to try to get it right. Still took several cuts.
You lying piece of...
Yeah. Well.
Anyway, when I talk a little bit about the subscription, the second hour will be for our members only this week. Yeah. Also... We have our merch store, so take a look at that. If you like anything, order it. If upcoming guests.
Dr. Robert Foreman coming up. And then the week after that, we have Mr. John Riley returning to the show. And then a Mary Magdalena.
Paul Levy, we don't have a date on him yet.
Yeah, we're working on reading his book, and then we'll set a date. But he'll probably could be coming in probably our first show in November. So, anyways, we've got good stuff on the horizon for tonight. Tom Campbell began researching altered states of consciousness but with Bob Monroe, Journeys Out of the Body, Far Journeys, and the Ultimate Journey, at the Monroe Laboratories in the early 1970s, where he and a few others were instrumental in getting Monroe's laboratory for the study of consciousness up and running. These early drug-free consciousness pioneers helped design experiments, developed the technology for creating specific altered states, and were the main subjects of study, also known as the guinea pigs, all at the same time. Campbell has been experimenting with and exploring this subjective and objective mind ever since. For the past 30 years, Campbell has been focused on scientifically exploring the properties, boundaries, and abilities of consciousness. During that same time period, he's excelled as a working scientist, a professional physicist, dedicated to pushing back the frontiers of cutting-edge technology, large system simulation, technology development and integration, and complex system vulnerability and risk analysis. Presently, and for the past 20 years, he's been at the heart of developing U.S. missile defense systems. Tom's the TC physicist, described in Bob Monroe's second book, Far Journeys, and has been a serious explorer of the frontiers of reality, mind, and consciousness, or consciousness and psychic phenomena since the early 1970s. My Big Toe is a model of existence and reality that's been based directly on Campbell's scientific research and firsthand experience. It represents the results and conclusions of 30 years of careful scientific exploration of the boundaries and contents of reality from both the physical and the metaphysical viewpoints. The author has made every effort to approach his exploration without bias or preconceived notions. There's no belief system, dogma, creed, or unusual assumptions at the root of My Big Toe. By demanding high-quality, repeatable, empirical evidential data to separate what is real, what exists independently and externally, from what is imaginary or illusory, Campbell has scientifically derived this general model of reality, also known as My Big Toe. Now, Tom, I wanted to start off with a quote right from Mr. Albert Einstein himself, which I think will set the stage perfectly here. Reality is merely an illusion, albeit a persistent one.
Yeah, I'm familiar with that quote.
Yes. So, this book, I really love the way that you put it in pretty much layman terms. I think just about anybody can actually grab this thing and understand it if they truly want to understand. One of the main things that I see is an essential to being able to grasp this and fold this into one's own personal paradigm is to be able to suspend their belief structures, their the dogma of society. Now, is that I think you talk about how do you put it in the book? The belief traps.
Yes. Yeah, belief is the probably number one enemy. Belief is a derivative of fear, and if you believe that something is true, or you believe that it's not true, then basically you're done. Your mind is closed on it because you've come to a conclusion that needs no further study. It's much better to keep what I call open-minded skepticism, so that you can decide whether this is probably true or probably untrue. But very few things should actually go all the way to a probability of a one or a zero. Most things should stay in that gray area where you're still open for more information to help you understand whether something is valid or not valid.
So I like the way that the ones and zeros, I like the way that you break this all down into a kind of a digital reality that we live in. That whole idea just opens up a whole wide range of possibilities of what's out there. I look at all these different experiences and contacts and different types of even into the getting into the far metaphysical side of it, the people who are doing the channelings and that sort of thing. And even looking at what I'm familiar with so far with my big toe and watching some of the lectures that you've done, it really has to make me question what are these people accessing? The possibilities for all these different data sets is tremendous. And, I have to suspend my own disbelief and consider the possibility that some of the things that these people are accessing is real.
Oh, sure. Most of what they're accessing is real, but the experience is real, but then they have to interpret that experience, and the interpretation of that experience comes out of their own personal database, if you will, their own experience base. So that's, their knowledge and their understanding, but also their fear and beliefs and all of that wrapped up together is what produces the interpretation of the experience or of the data that they get. We can't even form thoughts that we can think about, nor can we form words that we can put into a language until we take the data, take the content, the information, and reduce it to symbols and metaphors, because that's what language and thinking is in terms of. It's in terms of symbols and metaphors. So in a way, you can say, yes, there is something there. The data that they're getting is from outside of them. No, not always. Sometimes people just have a good imagination. But the data can be from outside of them, and oftentimes it is. But the interpretation is their own.
Right. So I understand that, because I have made my own personal connections. And what I seem to receive is like a, I call them a download, where I just get a whole ton of information all in one big chunk. And I have to go through kind of an unpacking process to try to decipher it. And so then it is my own explanation of what I experienced, what I saw, or what I felt, and the whole combination of everything.
Right. That's always the case. We can't help that, because all we get is information, all we get is data, and we have to interpret it. So you need to learn to read between the lines. It's not the, it's not the image. It's not the, the kind of the top level image and metaphors that you get. It's the meaning of those. What is it telling you between the lines? Somebody says, "Well, I saw a little green man with pointy ears." Well, the little green man with pointy ears is his interpretation of the data. You just say that he saw something that was strange that he didn't know how to interpret as a normal, or what he would consider to be a normal human-like being. So you learn to let the details go and look for the bigger picture in what's being said.
Right. That makes me I think Terrence McKenna said about one of his experiences while on psychedelics. He said he had a full-blown classical UFO appear in front of him. I mean, the very classic disc-shaped thing, and this being stepped out of it and said something like, "Is this what you were expecting to see?" or something like that. Mm-hmm. So it presented itself in a form that he was able to comprehend. Mm-hmm. So this whole consciousness field, I suppose probably the best place to start is, what is consciousness?
Okay, consciousness is a digital information system. That's the short answer. Right. A digital information system.
That's actually the best way I've heard it put.
Well, you know, that's not too. It's not too big a stretch to see that. Look at what is our consciousness. You know, well, here we are. We're sitting. I'm looking at a blank TV screen. You know, or a blank monitor. And I guess it's not blank. It's got Skype up because that's what we're using. So that's my visual reality anyway. And then you and I, we're speaking to each other. That's our acoustic reality. And what is all that? It's just data. It's just information. The sound that we hear, vibrates our eardrum, which moves a couple little bones in there, creates electrical signals, which turn into patterns of neurons. And that's just digital information. So our reality, our perception, is just data. So it's not such a huge stretch to say that consciousness is information.
And so within consciousness, within consciousness, we have the way you've described it in the book, we have all these different data sets which form these different realities. Am I making this mm-hmm. correct? So
yes.
So consciousness itself, the overall, I think you call it the AUM. AUM.
Yeah. Yeah. Just larger consciousness system.
Right.
I thought AUM would be cute because Tibetan sit.
Right.
I found some words to go with it. It's just my sense of humor.
But it's just
the larger consciousness system. Yes.
Yes. So within the larger consciousness system, we have all these different reality packets. And now, I would say an infinite number, but that would be my limited mind trying to picture how big this thing is. Mm-hmm. And this thing is, from my perspective, this thing is infinite. Is the way I mean, because I could not see the end of it.
Yeah, that's using infinite as a metaphor for the biggest thing that you can imagine plus a little more. You know, it's kind of bigger than what you can imagine. We call that infinite, but it's not really infinite in a technical sense. Infinity is something that's just an abstraction. It's something that nothing real can ever be infinite. So this larger consciousness system is indeed finite, although to us, from our viewpoint, it would appear to be infinite.
Right. Well, I kind of look at the as above, so below. So I have this whole reality, this whole reality packet that I call Tom, and it is all encompassed within one body, the flesh bag, the whatever we want to call it. So it would be, and maybe one of these little molecules that's in my hand looking out would see the rest of my body and not see the end of it and consider itself being in an infinite universe, which is just my body. So I see that I can definitely picture that. I can definitely mm-hmm. picture that. But that whole infinity thing just kind of hard to wrap my head around. I can see the different to have a reality within something, it has to be finite. I definitely understand that. But through the AUM, that almost seems like it would have to be, I don't know. It's just a bigger infinity. I just can't see it. it just seems like there's always got to be something on the other side.
Yeah, well, things have to be finite. Think of one of the analogy I use is if you're sitting in an inner tube in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, the ocean would appear to be infinite. No matter how long you paddle and or you know try to look, it would all look the same in every direction. You'd never see anything that looked any different, and you'd say, this ocean is infinite. Well, of course, we know the ocean's not infinite. It's just big compared to something small like you in an inner tube.
Right, right.
Mm. So one of the questions I have, how does the a physicist get into metaphysical, or is it, how does someone into metaphysical get into physics? Which one came first for you?
Well,
chicken
for
or
me,
the egg?
Yeah, it actually it's come both ways, but let me explain that. First, I was a physicist and was just out of graduate school, and then got introduced to Bob Monroe, who was just putting together a lab to study consciousness. So that was kind of my entree into metaphysics in an experiential way, you know, doing actual research with it. Before then, I had learned to meditate. I had taken the student TM course when I was a graduate student because they said that you would get by with less sleep. And for a graduate student, that's important because you tend to work very long hours, particularly if you're doing research. You tend to, like I was doing in experimental nuclear physics, you have this big atom smasher that bangs particles together, and it runs 24 hours a day. So when you're doing research, you need to get by with less sleep. So anyway, I was a physicist in that way first before I really got into meditation, and then with Bob Monroe and started studying consciousness and learning how to go out of body and that sort of thing. So that sense, physics comes first. But then when I wrote this book, or these books, it's a trilogy, My Big Toe, I wrote the books to explain the nature of reality, and that was mainly focused around consciousness, and it explained consciousness and, you know, the point and purpose of what you're doing and theology, you know, is there something larger than us, and if so, what's our relationship to it, you know, all these sorts of things that fall under metaphysics, because I'd come to understand kind of all of it within the context of one logical explanation. And then after I wrote the book, I started thinking a little more about the science part of it, and to my own surprise, I found out that the same theory that was explaining all of the metaphysics, if you will, also explained science. There was a bunch of scientific experiments that were just kind of outstanding, and nobody really knew how to explain them. There was the double slit experiment, and nobody knew why particles should be probability distributions. There was relativity, and nobody knew why the speed of light should be constant. There was work over several decades at Pear Labs, which is Princeton Engineering Anomalies Research, and they did a lot of mind-matter experiments, and they've done different kinds of experiments, and they found that the mind was influencing matter, and you know the probability of it being just chance was like one in a million, you know, so they had some real results. You had, you know, the Putoff and Targ out of the physics department in Stanford, California, doing remote viewing exercises, and that eventually was so successful that turned into a program in the CIA. So you had all this stuff going on, and people knew that it worked, but, you know, it was like this. Reality was really strange, it seemed, but they just didn't have any idea why. And then I realized that the same theory that I had done to explain the larger reality, mostly in terms of metaphysics, turned out to really do good physics because I could explain every one of those experiments exactly why they work the way they work. You know, and that's, you know, experiments. You have Bill Tiller who gets a beaker of water out of the spigot, so it's got a pH that's pretty neutral, like 7, and then with an intent, he can move the pH of that water up or down. This is stuff that's all on the YouTube videos. If you've probably seen most of them. You have Dr. Emoto who freezes ice crystals, and the ice crystals are pretty or ugly depending on whether he's thinking happy thoughts or ugly thoughts, you see. And all of these things can be explained precisely, logically, you know, scientifically, if you will, how they all work. So then you have metaphysics then deriving physics in that sense. But physics is kind of the thing you need to derive your understanding of reality, and metaphysics or consciousness is what you need to derive the physics.
I love the analogy you use with War of Warcraft. Fortunately enough, I never got into it because I knew once I got into it, I wouldn't let go of it. But with War of Warcraft, a lot of people would, for example, hack their character. So in our reality, as you were using the comparison, that this conscious we have is controlling like our reality and our body, like War of Warcraft. And some people are able to hack War of Warcraft and give themselves extra whatsoever. Is it a possibility to do the same in our reality?
Yeah, well, of course, we'll just use the word hacking as a metaphor to explain that you seem to somehow get outside of the rule set that's intended for the game and can do things beyond that. Yes, well, of course, that's possible. You are consciousness. Consciousness is the only thing that's fundamental. Everything else is derived from consciousness. This reality we're in is a virtual reality, like World of Warcraft or like The Sims or any of those multiplayer virtual reality games. That's what this reality, what we call our physical universe, is really a virtual reality. It's based on information. Consciousness, like I said, is a digital information field. So here we are in this virtual reality, and because we're consciousness, we can do all the things that consciousness can do, which means we can rise above this virtual reality. We don't have to just stay, we don't have to just keep our awareness inside the virtual reality. We can, and we can use your metaphor, we can hack that system and let our consciousness go elsewhere, go beyond this virtual reality into other virtual realities that are out there. It's sort of be like a character in World of Warcraft going over invading The Sims or something. You know, you can, if they're all running in the same computer, and you see, of course, if they were all, they're not, if they were all part of the same simulation, then that could happen. But of course, Sims and World of Warcraft are two distinct, different simulations, and that can't happen. But in our case, consciousness is the root of everything. So we can travel about and get information in a lot of ways that are not available to us as a member of the VR, virtual reality.
So when people have those experiences with other dimensional beings, and let's just call them that for now, is that somewhat what they do? They're coming into a different game set, for example?
Yeah, they are receiving information. Now, we automatic, if we get information that interacts with us, you know, like you say hi and somebody says hello back and you're having a nice day. If you're having an exchange of data, then we define that as a being. That's how we define it. That's our metaphor for that is a being, something that interacts with us. Secondly, we tend to make our beings, if the interaction seems kind of normal to us, then we make our beings look like humanoids. You know, they have head, arms, legs, body, that sort of things. Whether they're green and have little pointy ears, you know, it doesn't matter. That kind of depends on how strange you think what you're doing is. You know, you might get those little green things if you think it's a strange, out of this world kind of a thing. But anyway, yes, we get this data. This larger reality is full of virtual realities. There's all sorts of virtual realities there. And our universe is just one of a large number. So there are beings who are also out hacking the system, if you will, and traveling around in that larger reality, and you can interact with them. So you can have conversations. They can come visit this reality. You can go visit their reality. Once you realize your consciousness and learn how to control that consciousness. And control is kind of a funny word. It's not so much that you control it. What you're controlling is your normal sense of interfering with the consciousness. You just let that consciousness be and get into it. Then you're free, and you can bump into all sorts of things, beings, if you like, which will trade information with you.
The other part that I think is very important to address is the when you were talking in the video, you were talking about our fear and how certain beings, for example, would take advantage. Oh, no, the way you put it was, it's a big kick me sign.
Mm-hmm. Your fear, if you're fearful, then you probably shouldn't be out exploring in the larger reality, because the fear will attract things that will use that fear. And much of what you are afraid of will realize itself, you know, right in front of you there. So if you're really afraid that you're going to run into a monster that's going to get you while you're out exploring the larger consciousness, you will probably, first thing, see that monster, you see. So you create your own fears, and that way you're creating your own reality. Your fear then gets manifested into something that appears physical to you that you have to deal with. Sometimes the larger system will just, well, I would call, give you a fear test. And if you don't test well, which means if you react with a lot of fear, then basically the exploration, it gets closed to you. It scares you back into, you know, back out of that larger consciousness awareness back into this virtual reality. So it's, yeah, fear is the biggest problem in traveling in a larger reality. You need to be fearless.
Yeah, I had a spontaneous out of body back in the early 90s, and it just freaked me out. I just, like, heart started racing. I was like, ah, what the hell? And wham, I was right back in my body.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And it took me, almost 20 years. Just a couple years ago, I was able to do the conscious, you know, conscious intentional projection again.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's definitely a different world out there, isn't it?
It's a very different world than this VR. Well, they're both VRs. You know, what you experience when you're out of body is another virtual reality. It just has a very different rule set. It's not nearly as tight a rule set as the rule set in our universe.
Yeah, so we term going, when we go out into those different areas, we term that as a non-physical matter reality for ourselves.
Right. But, it's just right. And I would define non-physical as anything that is not this physical reality. In other words, if you're outside of this virtual reality, which we call physical, then we call whatever that is non-physical. Because the characters, if you're a character in The Sims, then what happens in that Sims VR is physical. And the server that's driving that Sims is non-physical, you see, to the characters that are in the Sims. So whether something's physical or non-physical is just a point of view. Whatever awareness, whatever reality frame you're in, whatever awareness you have, that appears to be physical. When you're dreaming, your dream appears to be physical. And this reality, this universe, is non-existent. It would appear to be non-physical. So there is really no such thing as physical and non-physical. It's all just the point of view of the observer.
Right. Okay, that's a point I was just trying to get to there. Perfect, perfect. So now I want to jump right back into the first part of the first book on this real quick about the end of the time section, how there is no space. There is no space without time, and there vice versa. And then Einstein's, you know, theory of relativity, and something that I found in the news here just recently of them shooting neutrinos from CERN through the planet at a speed faster than the speed of light. Are you familiar with this?
Oh yes, I'm familiar with that.
What is that? CERN? Yeah, it was CERN.
You sure? I thought it was here in Japan.
No, they did that experiment at CERN. It's in Europe. Right. Let's see, Central Europe, kind of think of the.
Switzerland.
Anyway, go ahead. So you're saying.
So what's that do to this whole? Does that do anything to your theory?
No, it has no effect on the theory. What my theory says is that, you know, it basically derives why the speed of light has to be a constant. You see, that was the big question in relativity. If you start with the assumption that the speed of light is constant, and by constant what we mean is that it's invariant relative to the speed of the platform on which the light descent. In other words, if you're driving in a car and a car's going 10 mile an hour and you reach your hand out the window and you throw a rock 10 mile an hour, the rock will be going 20 mile an hour with respect to the ground, right?
Right.
Because it's got 10 miles an hour from the car and 10 miles an hour from your throw, so it goes then the sum of those. And everything we know of is like that. If you have something that gets launched from a moving platform, then it has its velocity relative to its platform, plus it has the velocity of the platform. And that's the way everything except light works. Light doesn't work like that. You could be going 90% the speed of light, turn on a flashlight, and that flashlight beam would just travel the speed of light. And it didn't matter which direction you shined it, whether it was forward in the direction of your motion or backward in the opposite direction of your motion, it still just goes the speed of light always, no matter how the platform moves. So that was thought to be bizarre back in the late 1900s, that it was too bizarre that light would be constant, because nothing is. Einstein said, well, let's just, I think that it might be. Let's just assume that it is. And when he assumed that it is, he did a little algebra, and out comes special relativity from that algebra. And he says, well, given this assumption that light's constant, then we have all these bizarre things come out. As things go faster, they get heavier. Their mass increases. As they go faster, their length decreases. And as they go faster, their clocks tick slower. Their time slows down. So then you have this thing then was called the twin paradox, where a set of twins, one of them gets in a rocket ship, goes out into outer space at 0.9 times the speed of light, and then turns around and comes back. And when he gets back, you see, it's because it's, to go someplace, we have like light years in space. To go anywhere in space takes a long, long time, even at the speed of light. So let's say he goes out, a half a light year or something, turns around, comes back. What happens is his twin now on Earth is an old man, and he's just a few hours older than he was when he left because his time slowed down. So this physicist of the day looked at that, and this things get heavier, things get shorter. The things get shorter in a sense that in the direction of motion of the rocket ship actually shrinks and shrinks and shrinks until at the speed of light, the rocket ship goes to zero, has no length at all. And the mass grows and gets heavier and heavier and heavier. I'm saying heavy. It's really mass. Heavy is a little different, but you get the point. Right. Heavier and heavier and heavier until at the speed of light, it's infinite. Infinite mass, zero length, and time stands still. You see, all those things happen if matter goes the speed of light. So that's what the issue was. So Einstein got laughed at a lot for that because it seemed so bizarre. But then once they were able to test it, like put a cesium clock on a satellite, speed it around the Earth, a few hundred times, and then bring it back. Sure enough, the clock that stayed here now is ahead of the one that went around on the spaceship on the satellite. And they did the same thing with the lengthening, same thing with the mass. When you whirl those particles around in a cyclotron, you have to change the way the magnets are pulsed because the particles keep getting heavier and heavier the faster they go. So we know that all those things are true, and in fact, light is a constant. But nobody knew why. Why should light be constant? Why is it different? And in my theory, with the virtual reality, it explains why the light speed has to be a constant. Now, this thing that was done in CERN said that they've got a neutrino, which is like an electron with no charge, and that they believe that it's gone faster than the speed of light. One, that's yet to be, and it'll probably be a year before anybody knows for sure whether that is really what happened. Measuring neutrinos is a very, very subtle kind of thing. These neutrinos don't interact with things very well, right, because they have no charge and they're very, very small. They tend to just shoot right through matter of all sorts. It's only been very recently in physics that anybody ever thought they saw a neutrino. And we don't actually see neutrinos. We see the way we think neutrinos interact. We see results of neutrinos. So whether there's something wrong there or there's something else, nobody will know for a long time. But let's just say that does happen. Let's say that they have gone, these neutrinos do go faster than the speed of light. All that would say is that there is another particle that's faster than the speed of light, that is the one that produces the limit on the transfer of information. See, that's all the speed of light. I'm making it so it's hard to understand. In the virtual reality, you have to go from a discrete cell to a discrete cell. This is a digital reality, so it's computed. So your space is really, when you get to very small distances, it's clumpy. Your space is in cells, and you have to go from, you know, it's like pixels, right? On a screen. So you have to go from pixel to pixel to pixel. You can't jump from this pixel to one 200 pixels over, because then you're teleporting. Things are jumping around in your space. So they have to go consecutively from one pixel to the next, to the next, to the next. And that determines the maximum speed that information can travel in the system. Well, let's say that we always thought that was what photons did. That's light. That light was the fastest thing around. If something's a little faster, then that just says that, well, we can move information a little quicker. It doesn't really affect my theory. And my theory basically says that you have to have your information has to go consecutively through digital chunks of volume, if you will, and that those have to be constant. The delta V volumes have to be all the same size, otherwise your reality would be like looking in a funhouse mirror. Everything would be distorted.
Right.
A ruler held one place in the volume would be, you know, a foot long, and it would be, you know, a foot and a half some other place, just because it'd be like pixels on your computer screen weren't all the same size. You had big pixels and little pixels. See? As an image went through that, it would get distorted. Well, our reality isn't like that. It can't be like that, because this reality is a schoolhouse, and to have a good learning center, you need consistency. You can't have things jumping around. The feedback doesn't work very well that way. So anyway, that's it doesn't really matter what you call the particle, whether you call it a neutrino or a photon. The fact is that because it's a digital virtual reality, you have to have a constant for the fastest speed with which information can travel through the reality frame.
Okay, I got you on that. So the reality rule set is basically specific for each separate reality. I'm guessing like there's definitely realities where the speed of light is different, or they don't have light, or
right.
Wherever your imagination can go.
Yeah, that's right. They're all different, but I've been to many, and they're surprisingly similar. Part of that may be my interpretation, but part of it is that where this reality comes from, where we get this digital reality, isn't that a programmer sits down and programs it like they have to do The Sims or World of Warcraft. You know, in those games, if there's, you know, if in the World of Warcraft, if there's a tree, then somebody has to program that tree to be there. It has to be put in that spot, and it has to be designed by a programmer, and the programmer decides how much detail's in it, and so on. In our virtual reality, the scenes, if you will, the land, the universe here, is not programmed. It's evolved. So you start with a big digital bang in a computer, where inside the computer you put a small spot of energy. It's under high pressure, lots of energy, and then you hit the run button and it expands and cools, and you know, just like the Big Bang does, right. Except it's all done as a simulation in a computer. And then the gas, you know, it cools, it gets turns into suns and planets. You end up with a place like Earth, this digital, virtual, you know, computed universe, and then you have some cells, and they divide, and eventually you have us. You see, so we have just evolved in this simulation. So our whole set, the fact that we have these bodies like we have them, the fact that we cannot jump 20 feet in the air, that's not something that we can do. The rule set says that we're not designed for that. You know, we're too heavy and don't have big enough muscle, etc. So we don't do that. We can't learn calculus in 10 minutes. Our brain just can't do that because it's not evolved to do that. So the set, the body, the brain, the environment that we have, the universe, basically sets the constraints in this virtual reality experience, just like the programming sets the constraints in the World of Warcraft or in The Sims. The Sims characters can only do certain things. They can't jump 20 feet high either because, you know, they're supposed to be modeling humans, right? So they, don't do that. But, you know, in the World of Warcraft, you have some different kinds of creatures who can do some unusual things.
Yes,
you know? Like lions, you know, with wings that fly and that kind of thing. So that's because their rule set allows that. So our rule set was evolved, and here we are, consciousness. We're getting a data stream that we interpret as this physical reality, and we can only get things in that data stream that are consistent with the way this virtual reality evolved in the big digital bang. So that's, you know, so you talk about a brain. The brain obviously does not create consciousness. The brain actually doesn't store anything, doesn't do any thinking. All that's done in consciousness. The brain just sets the constraints on what we can do. We can't do anything that didn't evolve in this virtual reality. Now, if somebody comes and hits you in the head with a pipe and your brain gets damaged, then your constraints just got increased. Now there's more things you can't do that you used to do, you see? So that's the way the system works. We live in a virtual reality that is an evolved set rather than a program set.
So you think our evolved Big Bang, our digital Big Bang, does it have conscious direction?
Well, it was computed for us to be, you know, it was made for us to learn in, so that we could get involved in this virtual reality, interact with each other, and therefore evolve our consciousness.
So similar to way DNA works within us, as in DNA. You know, this is probably reaching out a bit, but as far as DNA having the patterns of so many different things within it.
Well, yes, if we look at it like that, this reality frame is a fractal reality. It's what I call a process fractal. Now, you've probably heard of geometric fractals, and what they are is simple equations that will give you maybe a geometric shape like a triangle.
Right.
And then you put another triangle on all the sides of that triangle, and then you put more triangles on the sides of those triangles, and you keep building up this stuff with different size, bigger triangles, smaller triangles, different scales, and you end up with a fractal image. And a fractal image can be often reminds you of landscapes, sky, water, rocks, trees, you know, that starts to look like our physical reality. That's because this is a fractal reality. That's why fractals look like, that's another thing, you know, another puzzle solved there. This is a fractal reality. That's why fractals represent it so nicely. But we are a process fractal, which means you have the evolutionary process. Try what's available to you to try and see what works. The stuff that works moves forward. The stuff that doesn't work dies off. You know, that's the basic process. And you can build that process at different levels and scales and make a fractal process, fractal process out of that scheme. And that's the kind of reality you have. So we have consciousness that has created this virtual reality. So yes, it's an aware consciousness. It's created this virtual reality for subsets of itself, for consciousness to experience in, so that we can learn. We can reduce the entropy of our little piece of consciousness, because every bit that we grow, the whole system grows. It reduces the entropy in the whole system. So that's what's going on. Yes, there is a kind of a tiered thing there, where you get data only at that fractal level of detail that's necessary for what it is you're doing.
So right now, looking at our world, looking at the consciousness of the planet, I see a lot of changes going on in a lot of different levels, and you could probably deduce from the name of our show that we are very familiar with the 100th monkey effect. What are your views on that 100th monkey effect? Is it a real phenomena?
Oh yes. Maybe we ought to define that a little more carefully. But the 100th monkey effect is that 100th monkey maybe I won't say it that way. It's that consciousness transmits information, and other consciousness receives that information, so that we get information just from consciousness to consciousness that does not come through any physical reality means. It's just if one consciousness knows something, then other consciousness begin to pick that up or begin to be made easier for them to pick that up. It becomes more intuitive to them to pick that up. Would that be fair to say that that's your definition of the 100th monkey?
Absolutely, absolutely.
Okay, so yes, that works. And the reason it works is here we are all individuated units of consciousness, which we call ourselves human beings. But, you know, so are cats and dogs individuated units of consciousness as well. You know, it's not just people. But here we are, and all units of consciousness are netted. We're on this big net, sort of like the internet. I call it the reality-wide, you know, web. So all consciousness is netted. Now, we know for a fact that consciousness affects other consciousness, even if there's no physical means. We know that in a mob, right? If you have a mob together, that mob will act worse. You know, it acts like the lowest common denominator in the mob. So it'll act worse than any of the people in the mob would have acted by themselves. It feeds on itself. The negativity feeds on itself. And just the opposite effect, the anti-mob, if you will, if you have people who are full of love and caring and peace and understanding, and as you get in and around and interact with those people, you feel better, you feel lighter, you feel more inclined toward understanding and peace and charity and those kinds of thoughts come easier for you, and that can then pull you up, just like the negative mob can drag you down. That's the way it works, and there's lots of things. You know, who was it? Carl Jung talked about archetypes. It's a similar kind of thing. His archetypes were basically cultural metaphors that had spread not just through, say, a Western culture, but some of it is at the level of being human, where we have these archetypes, these ideas that have just spread everywhere. And some of them are cultural, like go to places that have long, deep cultures, which mainly take you to Europe or Africa rather than the U.S. The United States, you know, our country didn't start until just a blink ago in time, so we don't have the 4,000 years of culture that you'd get in Mesopotamia or some place. But in any case, if you look at different cultures, they have different ways of looking at reality. These ways aren't that somebody teaches you in school. They're just there. You know, you get it because you're getting it. You're getting the attitudes. You're getting that sense of the way things are just from the consciousness of the other people that you're around. So sure, the 100th monkey effect is real in as much as all consciousness is netted. That's how telepathy works. That's how a mother knows when her child's hurt someplace, even though she hasn't gotten the telephone call yet. You know, things like that occur all the time. And
so do you think there's a critical mass that can be reached that the knowing just spreads?
Oh, yes, there is. You know, we can do the same thing on the positive end that, you know, that mobs do. You can get a whole culture, you can get a whole country that's become very martial and very, wants to go to war, and everybody's in this war mode. Well, you can also get a whole country that everybody's in a peace mode.
Right.
You know, one thing, you know, fear drives one, love drives the other. So in as much as the environment is fearful, we tend to be drugged down. And as much as the environment is more love-like, more compassionate, we tend to be pulled up. So yes, you can get a critical mass. If there were enough people who were love-like, compassionate, and caring, then that would drag a lot more people with them. And if you get to a critical mass where it snowballs, then yes, you can have a rather major change take place rather quickly.
Yeah, I'm looking at this. We've got the 11-11-11 coming up, and yeah. in this field that Ramon and I are in, there's a lot of the quote unquote new age and the esoteric and mystical people who there's a lot of feel good. I call them fluffy. A lot of fluffy love stuff, which is good stuff. Mm-hmm. But there's all sorts of different meditations going on this 11-11-11. And I've really got some high hopes myself for seeing some change come out of all the different meditations that are going to happen that day. Yeah. I mean, there's going to be a huge mass of people that are actually focusing their intent on peace, on love.
You know? Yes. Well, of course, one of the feedback mechanisms in our reality frame that helps us grow up here is that we can modify future probability. We can modify the probability of what happens next with our intent. Okay, now, since we live in a virtual reality that's computed, this reality gets ready to compute the next thing by projecting what is most likely to happen. And actually, it looks at everything that could possibly happen and the probability that it might happen. And then, given that that's true, it goes out the next delta T of its simulation cycle and says, well, if that's true, then what would happen in the next delta T, and so on. So there's this database that I call the probable future database. Those are the things that then are likely to happen. We can influence the probability of something being likely to happen just by focusing our intent on that thing happening. So that's what explains the placebo effect. You know, everybody knows the placebo effect. That is, if somebody gives you a sugar pill and tells you it's a wonderful new magic medicine, it will actually help you get well from whatever it is that's ailing you. You know, if it's this is great medicine, it'll make your kidneys better, or it will you know, make your heart work better. And about 35-40% of the people who take that pill that actually has no medicine in it will get better kidneys or heart or whatever it is. It's not just that they think they're better. It's they really do get better, whereas the control group doesn't. So how does that work? Well, it works because they get now a positive intent toward that illness, and that positive intent modifies the probabilities. So the probability's just gone up that they're going to get better rather than get worse. So it all depends on uncertainty. You know, when you're in this kind of a reality, it works on probability and statistics. So where there is uncertainty, natural uncertainty in something, and there's lots of uncertainty in health issues because the body is a very complicated thing, so there's lots of uncertainty, then you can use your intent to shift the probability within the limits of that natural uncertainty. That's how we heal with our minds. You also can collect data out of the system. When we see auras, what we're doing is we're collecting the data about that person, and we are telling the system we want to see that in a visual, you know, as a picture, if you will, representing the person, and then that's how we see it. We could see it some other way. If we wanted graphical output, we could get it that way. The system is like any database system. You query it with your intent, and you can specify the output format. When people heal with their minds, they take a white light beam, and they burn away black pieces that represent the bad health, you know, in a body. They look at a body and say everything that's good health is white and the stuff that's not healthy is black. Then they go in with their white light and they burn away the black stuff, and that's how they heal. That's one technique, how you heal someone with your mind. Well, there is no such thing as light. Light's just a metaphor. The fact that the bad stuff is black, that's just a metaphor. You could just as easily say, I want all the healthy stuff to be shiny black and all the bad stuff to be, you know, white. And matter of fact, that's actually a better output format if you're looking for very tiny things like individual cancer cells that maybe weren't gotten in a surgery. It's much easier to see something white that's shiny and has a little beam coming out from it on a black field than it is to see some tiny black speck on a white field. So all of those things are just metaphors. The light's a metaphor. Energy's a metaphor. And the only active ingredients is conscious intent, because the conscious intent changes the data. The data represents the world, represents our virtual reality. So that's kind of we're kind of jumping around here. I hope we're not confusing your listeners too much. But anyway, that's how that works.
So.
Yeah. Okay. I wanted to give you an example of what happens to me with the placebo effect. So, for example, let's say I have a headache, and as soon as I put the pill in my mouth, the headache's gone. So it's obvious that it's not the pill because it hasn't even had a chance to digest yet. Yet I know this consciously that I have always this placebo effect with medicine. Mm-hmm. So even with cough medicine, so if I have a really stuffy nose, as soon as I put it in my mouth, my stuffy nose is gone.
Hmm. Yeah.
So well, either I'm getting really good stuff or...
yeah, well, your mind controls those things because it's all just data. You see, it's not that you have to do anything other than modify the probabilities of the data stream that's coming to you defining this reality. So, yes, the placebo effect works like that, and that works in many ways. You know, why do we have to do all of our soft science with double-blind experiments and triple-blind experiments? The reason we have to do double and triple blind for what a soft science is, psychology, sociology, economics, because these things have to do with people, and people have a lot of uncertainty, and we can modify that uncertainty with our intent. So if you have experimenters who have an intent about the way they'd like the experiment to come out, it comes out that way, you right. see. When if your experimenters have no idea what's going on because they're double and triple blind, then you get a different answer. So we found out just experimentally that when you deal with uncertain systems, if you don't do double and triple blind, you will affect the result with your mind. And, you know, it's just common. It's not just placebo, but, you know, lots of things work that way. And that pill then for you is a tool, okay? The pill is a tool that helps you focus your mind. So just like that light beam of that light worker who is going to heal that black spot by making the black spot go away, that light beam is just a tool, you see? Hmm. So the pill's a tool.
Well, we're nearing the top of the hour here, so
oh, yeah.
I want to give Tom a chance to put out his website here for our BBS listeners and where they can pick up this fantastic big toe. And good stuff. Good stuff. So, Tom, where can we get the big toe?
Okay, you can get it lots of places. You can go to your neighborhood bookstore and order it if they don't have it on the shelf. They'll know how to get it through their sourcers. Baker & Taylor is a wholesaler that services the whole world, and they have it. You can get it at Amazon. You can get it at Barnes & Noble online. And you can, I even think Books A Million carries it. You can get it at my website, and that's probably cheaper than on any of those places. And my website is www.mybigtoe.com. And if you are interested, you can read it for free on Google Books. I have it there in its entirety. And I don't know the address for Google Books. That's going to be real long and complicated. But go to Google and look up Google Books and then put in My Big Toe, and it'll take you to it. And if you want to know something about it before you get a book, you can go to YouTube, and I've probably got 20 or 30 videos, some of them very extensive, like the New York workshop. That's in five parts, and each part's like an hour and a half. So that's like 7 hours, 7.5 hours worth of video explaining many of the things that we're talking about today. And you can get little short things that are only, you know, 5 or 10 minutes long that just look in one subject, like, you know, what happens when you die, or what about vegetarianism, and on and on and on and on, things that are kind of shorts. And you get things in between. There's a Hawaii seminar, and that's kind of pretty short. That's like 2 hours, hour and a half, something like that. And it does a pretty good short job of doing things. And there's one from Emory University that's only 1 hour. So if you kind of browse around there, you can get something that's quick or something that's longer. Depends on how much detail you want.
Great. Okay, guys.
Oh, I should tell you one other thing. YouTube is a big place. TWCJR44. TWCJR44. That's the YouTube address if you want to get to that site.
Okay, we'll have links to that on the website. So we'll have links to we'll dig up that link to Google Books too and put that on the website also. So I want to thank everybody for listening to this first hour. After Brooks Agnew is done with his show, pop on over to the website and jump into the members section and listen to the second half. Condemnation without investigation is the height of ignorance, and we love you guys.